Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello there, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, and this week quite a packed show with looking back at the Australia-India one-day internationals, a little bit about England in the West Indies. We've got, after the break, an interview with the new Lords groundsman, Carl McDermott, who has some interesting things to say, actually, about things like weather changing, weather patterns and stuff, and the pressures on groundsmen.
And how grumpy groundsmen are as well.
Yeah, well, some of them are shockers, actually. Not him, though, I have to say, basically. Also, a little bit of a reference to the new Cricketer magazine and a new column we've got from Andrew Sampson, the wizard on TMS. He's come up with some interesting stats. First, after your daughter's riddle last week, we've had a riddle this week from Danny McGee. And he says, well, the only cricketing riddle that I know is which number batsman is left not out if every batsman gets out first ball? Now, don't answer it now. Have a little think about it.
Not sure I can. I need to think about it.
It's quite a tricky one. So, which batsman is left not out if every batsman is out first ball at the start of an innings? Right. Just have a little thinker, ponder on that one, and we'll come back to it. But Australia-India. Now, I've just been covering that second one-day international for BT, and it was a one-all situation now. So the final game is at the weekend at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. I thought it was quite interesting, actually. I mean, it was a great game. It was well contested. But I think there's some flaws in both teams that England can exploit. In a way, I felt, actually...
When you say England can exploit, you mean for the World
ultimately,
Cup?
Yeah. I think that, in a way, the game made England's chances of winning the World Cup better for me, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Australia seem to have this sense that they don't want to pick their leg spinner for some reason. They keep picking Nathan Lyon and Glenn Maxwell. And I can't believe they're still going with two old-fashioned old-school off-spinners in one-day internationals and nobody to bowl wrist spin or mystery spin of any kind. I don't think you can totally judge Australia's other bowlers at the moment because they aren't playing the likes of Mitchell Starc and Hazelwood and Pat Cummins and so on. They're playing their sort of second line of seam bowlers. So it's probably a bit unfair to make too much of a judgment on their faster bowlers, but I can't believe they're not playing the spinners like Adam Zampa, for instance. And with that reference in mind, I will just mention Andrew Sampson's column in the New Cricketer magazine out on Friday. One of the things he says in his new column, Stats Life, is that Nathan Lyon has become the first test spinner, or the first test bowler, actually, to be hit for 200 sixes. He's overtaken Murali. And it's quite a difficult one to work out, he says, because, actually, if you go back in stats, you get batsmen sixes and fours, mostly, until about the, sort of, from about the 1970s 1980s, you get most of the batsmen sixes and fours in innings or in a career, etc. But you don't necessarily find out which bowlers were hit for sixes and fours, because they didn't do ball-by-ball coverage online until more recently. So you had to go through old score books and things like that to figure out how many sixes bowlers of the sort of ilk of Murali conceded. But Murali, I think, was on 198. It's been estimated 194 to 198 sixes against Murali, and Nathan Lyon's just gone past 200.
So it's impossible to actually nail down.
I think he has been through, and knowing Andrew, as
yeah,
we do,
yeah,
he's been through the books very carefully and established that there's a range. Murali is either 194 or 198, and that's the sort of low and high of it.
Yeah.
He's not 200.
Yeah.
Nathan Lyon's gone past 200. This is in Test cricket. And he also says that there have been seven sixes hit per test in the 21st century, roughly double the rate of the preceding 40 years.
Yeah.
So definitely more power, shorter boundaries, more ambition for the batsman.
I mean, in a way, those stats are no surprise, are they? Nathan Lyon is bowling a lot of overs. Batsmen are more attacking. They're taking that white ball cricket into test match cricket. And it's inevitable that the off-break bowler is going to be hit for six more often, I think.
And actually, the off-spinner generally, I think ever since Shane Warne got involved in T20 in the beginnings of the IPL, really, off-spinners started to get marginalised in one-day cricket, because they just felt they were too easy to hit for the right-handers. And orthodox spinners, they'd come back in test cricket, but I think in one-day cricket, unless you've got a ball which sort of does something a bit different, it's hard to sustain a long-term career. I mean, there are people like Jadeja, I suppose, who bowls orthodox left-arm, but he sort of fires them in, he bats as well. So those orthodox spinners... James Treadwell survived for a little while for England, but those orthodox off-spinners, I just think, are not going to win a World Cup. Going on to India and how England can take encouragement from the Indian performance, Dhoni. Now, I've looked at his stats over the last 2 years. His strike rate is 67. Mm. And it went up a little bit today. He got a good 50, but it was a scratch of 50 to start with. He struggled. I thought he struggled enough to force Kohli to play more aggressively, and he then got out. And Dhoni, in the end, did finish the game. And I'm getting torrents of abuse on Twitter for suggesting that the hero of so many run chases, that the king of finishers, Dhoni, should be marginalised by the Indians. But I do believe it. And if you look at the strike rates of other people batting five and six around the world in one-day internationals, you know, the likes of Glenn Maxwell, Joss Butler, David Miller, people like that, their strike rates are 120, 115, something like that. Dhoni, his strike rate is 67 in the last 12 months. And that means, for those who are not that sort of stats savvy, he would score about 210. If he batted the whole of an innings in a 50-over game, he'd score 210. Well, that's not going to win many games.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised you've got lots of comment on Twitter. I saw actually a tweet from Mel Farrell. She asked a similar question. She posed a question about, you know, Dhoni's future in the Indian one-day squad, and someone responded, "Did he want a quiet evening, Mel?" You know, inevitably going to get a huge amount of response to that. I mean, last summer at Lord's, I saw Dhoni play one of the most incredible one-day innings.
In a
bad way. I do not know what he was doing. I don't know what he was trying to do. It was anti-cricket. It was hideous. It was absolutely hideous. It was a horrible day, a horrible afternoon for those people who pay their money to turn up at Lord's. I mean, he barely played a shot in anger. I'm still perplexed to know what was going on. He has played that way. He's played conservatively at the start of his innings for quite a long time now, and then he's trusted himself to explode, hasn't he, and win the game and become a finisher, and he's done it many times as well. That's the point, isn't it? But the closer you go to 40, then, you know, the harder it becomes. And it was also interesting watching him bat. I know it was very hot, wasn't it, in Adelaide?
Yeah, it was very hot.
It was extremely hot, but I've noticed Kohli and Dhoni were really struggling. All that running between the wickets. Of course, Dhoni's keeping wicket for 50 overs as well. I mean, that's a punishing day out, that is, in the heat of Adelaide. You know, inevitably, what is he, 37 now?
37.
Yeah, time takes its toll on anyone. And there's that sort of delicious, sort of tempting, teasing situation for India, because they've got Rishabh Pant, who is a tremendously talented young player, and, you know, keeps wicket as well. He's got on the test side, and, you know, he's such a dasher. And you could see him, in a World Cup, vital World Cup match, going out there and winning a game, in a click of a fingers, in a blink of an eye. So, what do they do? Is he too inexperienced? Do you stick with the experience of Doney for one more World Cup? I'm presuming they will.
In fact, what I think they might do is they might put him at number four, because they're struggling for a number four. They've got Kohli at three. They've obviously got Rohit Sharma and Shikhar Dhawan to open.
Yeah.
Kohli at three. Amberty Ryder, who batted four, he looked absolutely terrible. And then Dhoni came in at five. And I wonder whether Dhoni might play actually as a batsman. Because actually the other funny thing is, he hadn't kept wicket for 2 months. And apparently, Adam Gilchrist said, he saw Dhoni keeping wicket in practice today for the first time ever. Normally, he bowls, doesn't he? He has a bowl with the seamers, and he doesn't do any keeping practice at all. But he's obviously feeling, well, I haven't kept for 2 months, apart from the last One Day International the other day. I better do a bit of keeping practice. And I think the other thing about him, that he is essential to the Indians for one sort of rather bizarre reason, and that is captaining on the field towards the end of an innings, because Kohli wants all the real boundary runners, the quickest men, to patrol the boundary. Kohli's one of them.
Mm.
So Kohli's on the boundary towards the end of a one-day innings. He can't captain from long off. So actually, Dhoni, using his experience and knowledge, is sort of moving the fielders around and just sort of getting angles and things like that. So actually, in many ways, Dhoni is still quite important to India, even though I think his batting is in decline. One other point about his batting. Yeah, I mean, people are going to say to me, well, how can you drop the greatest match winner of all time? He's won 193 games for India. Well, not on his own, but he's played in 193 winning teams. And I just thought there was a six he hit. He didn't really quite get it. And it, compared to the sixes he's hit in the past, which sort of go onto the roof, his sixes today just... Yeah, he didn't quite have it. I mean, yeah, he was a bit tired and he'd been rushing up and down. His speed between the wickets is still pretty good. But I don't know. I just think there's a few signs of sort of slight decline there, which England might be able to play on in the World Cup.
Yeah. Well, I still think India are going to be strong in England. Yeah. They're going to have massive support, aren't they? And they can get on a roll and get that momentum going. And you'd expect them. I'm sure they will. I'd be absolutely amazed if they didn't make the semi-finals. And then, it's on the day, isn't it? And you feel the same about England as well. We've said it for a long time now. England would have to have an incredibly bad World Cup not to make the semi-final. So once you're there...
Mm. It's all on the day, isn't it?
It's so much on the day as it was in the Champions Trophy. But the thing is, with Kohli in your side, he plays one of those sensational innings. Yeah. You've always got a chance. 39 one-day hundreds already.
Yeah.
And that feeling, he's going to pass Tendulkar. We've said it before that he's still got another, was it 11? He's got another 12 to go to reach Tendulkar. And 12 hundreds in one day cricket is a very good career for somebody. For Kohli, assume he's going to get there.
I don't think too many Englishmen have made 12. Yeah. I mean, I know Root's made 11 or 12, and I think Triscothic might have got that, but not many others. So you can beaver away and look that up for a sec, but. I tell you, it just shows how much India still rely on Dhoni and Kohli, because our friend Dan Weston, the stats man, suggested today that when India win, Kohli averages 83 and Dhoni averages 70.
Yeah.
When India lose, they both average 35.
Yeah. Most one-day hundreds for England, Root 13, Triscothic 12... and Morgan 10, Peterson 9. So that puts
it. He's got three times as many as any of them.
And it also puts into context what he's got to do to beat Tendulkar or go level with Tendulkar. And you just assume he's going to do it.
Yeah.
Probably by the end of the year, the way he's going. Yeah. Probably in the World Cup on his. Has he got enough matches in the World Cup? No, not nine. Yeah, he has.
Well, nine games he's got.
Yeah, you've got nine group mate matches and a knockout and a final.
Final, yeah.
You get 11.
God, that would be something, wouldn't it?
Just on Nathan Lyon, you made the point about Lyon, and why is he in the Australia team? Well, I think a couple of reasons, really. One is that they're sort of scouting around. They've been scouting around for a spinner. He's been bowling so well in Test cricket. He's hardly played any one-day cricket for Australia. He's only played 17 one-day internationals. They feel that he might go well in England. I think they're having a look at him, see whether it works. But you look at I think it's been interesting watching the Big Bash over the last few weeks is that most teams seem to have a decent young leg spinner, or they have a leg spinner. Some teams have two leg spinners. So it's a bit like it in English cricket in the Blast, where lots of teams have leg spinners. Australia are developing some leg spinners as well. Tom O'Connell played the other day for the Melbourne Stars. He made his debut at 18 years of age.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and he was hit for six first ball, but he did get a wicket.
His first ball in a bash.
First ball in the bash was hit for six. But I mean, you know, they're prepared to throw in a young leg spinner, 18 years of age.
Yeah.
So they're obviously looking around for that sort of bowler.
You know, the Rajasthan Royals actually picked a guy called Pravin Tambe in about the fourth year of the IPL, who was 41, had never played even professional cricket. He'd only played in Mumbai 20-over league cricket. They plucked him out of obscurity and he played a whole season. He actually got them to the Champions League finals, though they didn't win it.
Yeah. Just before actually everyone writes in and emails in and...
I
get flooded by people on Twitter. Tendulkar's 51 test hundreds, 49 one-day hundreds. He's only actually got to get another 10 to go level with Tendulkar in one-day hundreds. Yeah.
Yeah, also no letters for that one because he's corrected himself just in time. Now, OK, so Australia-India, that's well poised. It's been good cricket. England in the West Indies, about to get ready for the Test series there. And what we thought we'd do, we'll preview the Test series next week. There's a big feature on the tour in the Cricketer magazine this month, looking ahead to it from the perspectives of two old-timers, Derek Pringle and David Gow, what it's like to tour there. And also sort of highlighting one or two of the great moments from Caribbean tours of the past. I remember the Curtly Ambrose 6 for 10 in Trinidad, bowling England out for 46, and also the great Lara 375. But you can beat that.
I could top that. I was there for his 400 not out. I mean, just incredible. You just knew he was going to do it. That was the most bizarre thing about it. You know, he had 70, 130, just knew he was going to get there. It was the flat pitch. They booked in for bed and breakfast. He looked really determined. He'd done it before. He wanted his record back because obviously Matthew Hayden had taken his record. And it just seems bizarre to say that, you know, when he still had another 200 and odd to go. It's a bit like Kohli, isn't it? Yeah. With his 10 one-day hundreds that he needs to equal Tendulkar. You just felt it was absolutely inevitable. Yeah. Anyway, that is the highest test score of all time. It's one of the most unbelievable innings you could ever witness, for its just utter determination and ruthlessness and drive to get to where he wanted to get. What we'd like to know from you is, okay, that was the highest test score of all time, but what was the best innings that you've ever seen? And it might be in a one-day game, it might even be in a club match. You know, you might have played in the club game and someone played an amazing innings. Write in and tell us what was the best innings you've ever seen in any form of cricket. So it can be a test match or a one-day game, it can be a county game or an overseas game, anything. And the email address for that is...
theanalystpodcast@gmail.com.
theanalystpodcast@gmail.com. So we'd love to hear from you about the best innings you've ever seen.
Yeah, and we'll read the best ones out, definitely.
And tell us why as well. Don't just say, you know, Basil D'Oliveira or whatever, 160 or whatever. You know, just, yeah, tell us why as
I
well.
Think one of the reasons I loved the 375, Brian Lara 375, actually, in Antigua, was the atmosphere in the ground, because I always felt that old ground, the Antigua Recreation Ground, it was a party, it was a carnival sort of atmosphere. Chickie's Disco. Mm. You remember that? The kind of DJ kind of kept blaring out the music. There was Gravy, the cross-dresser, standing on a kind of platform overlooking the ground floor, sort of on the first floor of the stand. I loved the iron band that would kind of go around the ground playing all these metal things like hubcaps and pipes and things in syncopated rhythm. And I just thought it was like a carnival of cricket, a festival of cricket, never mind what was going on the field. So.
Yeah. I've sort of come to it late in terms of Caribbean tours, but I think one of the really sad things that's been lost has been that West Indian support there. I mean, I've been to Barbados where you just see
English
support, and you don't get that balance in the crowd. And I think that going to the West Indies has lost something because you don't have those fast bowlers roaring in anymore. I mean, they're just, you know, fantastic sight. We were actually discussing before we started this podcast about, you know, what you'd actually prefer to see. Would you prefer to see spinners in operation, or would you prefer to see fast bowlers, you know,
and there was something tremendously exciting about it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In a funny kind of way, the bouncer, it was it was celebrated in the Caribbean and it was feared in England. Yeah. And that was a very distinct sort of cultural difference between the two countries and the way they play cricket. You know, when you watched a bouncer in a Caribbean sort of state game, inter-island game, you know, it was all, oh, give him some, like that, you know, and they loved it. And batsman had a big waft and the ball flew through the keeper, top edge, or it was a moment of excitement and sort of bravado. And in England, when someone bowled bouncers, West Indians came and bowled bouncers in England, it was this sort of feared and intimidatory thing, and everyone was a bit nervous about it. And obviously that's changed now because the helmets are much better and there aren't the same conveyor belt of quick bowlers in the West Indies either. But it certainly sort of really emphasised the difference in the two cricketing cultures.
Yeah. I suppose in a way it sort of began to turn for England in the Caribbean in 2004 with Steve Harmison, that amazing spell you talked about. Grievous bodily Harmison was the headline in the newspaper the next day. Since then it's turned around. There isn't that sort of dominance from West Indies fast bowlers.
Although they might.
Well, they've got one or two, Shannon Gabriel, for example.
We'll talk about that next week.
Anyways, but send us the best innings. Send us examples of the best innings that you've ever seen.
We'll take a break, and after that, we'll talk to the new Lords groundsman. Right, now, before we talk to Carl McDermott, I'd just like to perhaps answer that riddle. Because it's
are you not
going to
wait till next week, then?
No, I'm not going to wait till next week. No. You know, people's... How do you keep an idiot in suspense? I'll tell you next week. The thing is, it's a simple one, really. Now, the answer, and I'm reminding you of the question again, which batsman's left not out if all the players are out first ball?
Yeah, it's one of those, if you sit down with a piece of paper, you can work it out, but actually to work it out in your head and talk at the same time as I'm trying to do now is quite tricky, so
Hold on,
the first six batsmen are going to be out at one end.
Yeah.
And then the bowling is going to go to the other end. So numbers 1, 3,
very good.
4, 5, 6, and 7 are going to be out.
Yes, correct.
Then the other opener is going to... It's number 8.
Very good.
Is it number 8?
It is number 8.
The number 8, yeah.
And a lot of people will say number 7 or number 9 or whatever. It's number 8 because the non-striker, when the opening pair go out, is number 2.
Yeah.
And he hasn't faced a ball.
Yeah.
So as the first six wickets fall, so then he faces the first ball of the second over, and his partner is number 8, who's coming after number 7, who was out at the end of the first over.
Yeah.
So number 8 is the non-striker when number 2 is out at the beginning of the second over, followed by numbers 9, 10 and 11. Mm. And so number 8 is left not out.
Excellent.
Thank you very much, anyway, to Danny for that question. Right, now we're going to talk to Carl McDermott. Interesting character, actually. Mick Hunt, of course, being the groundsman at Lords since the late 80s. And he, in fact, started at Lords. I remember in 1981, he was a sort of ground staff apprentice then. So he'd been there for 40-odd years and lived in that house by the nets for most of that time. So he's got to find somewhere else to live, poor old Mick, actually, which is not easy. It's like the old sort of clergyman or the vicar who has to move out of the vicarage and find somewhere else to live. So he's hunting around for a house, I think, at the moment, Mick, probably missing all that space out the back of his back windows of Lords and the nursery and everything. Carl comes from Ireland. It's a very adventurous and interesting appointment. Lovely guy. He was the groundsman at Clontarf in Dublin, where I've played and rudely described the wicket about 20 years ago as like rolled Weetabix, because it was all sort of a bit crusty and it had no substance to it at all. Anyway, he was the groundsman there in Clontarf for some years. Then he moved to Worcester. Then he went down to Aegeus Bowl, Hampshire, Southampton, and he was there for 7 years, 3 as head groundsman, and finally got the job at Lords. And I was very interested to meet him because I've been so familiar with Mick Hunt for virtually all my life at Lords, and his sort of cockney way of looking at things, his terrible jokes, always wearing a pair of shorts, even in the worst weather. And just actually, he always wore these sort of deck shoes on the outfield as well, which I never quite got. But anyway, you know, fantastic guy, Mick. Finally, he's been succeeded by Carl. And so I thought I'd take Carl into the middle at Lords and experience with him his first sort of couple of days at the headquarters of cricket. We're standing in the middle at Lords. It's now your terrain. How does it feel to be head groundsman at Lords, the home of cricket?
I I sort of haven't had the moment of realisation yet, to be honest. I think that'll probably happen when the season kicks in, and I've sort of got quite quickly into the routine of walking out here and not really taking in the surroundings. So probably when the stadium's full on the first morning of the World Cup or something like that, I think I'll probably have a few butterflies then, and then the realisation of everything that comes with it, to be honest. A lot of my friends have asked me, oh, do you believe it? Do you believe it? No, I don't believe it, but sort of hasn't really sunk in yet, so to speak.
But you're standing out here.
I know.
This is the pitch that they'll be probably playing the Ashes or the World Cup final on. I mean, it must be exciting.
It is, but I look at the grass from a cricketing point of view more than the venue point of view, so at the moment. It's very exciting, yeah, very, very exciting. The Irish Test would probably be one of the highlights for me, I think, this year.
I mean, that's amazing, isn't it? The first year that you're the groundsman here, your own countrymen playing their first ever Test at Lord's.
I've got a few messages saying the master plan is in place now, so you just need the Irish to win.
So there's no collusion going on there with Carl and the Irish cricketers, although if they suddenly produce at Lord's for the Test match in July, four-day game, a pitch which sort of nibbles around a little bit and doesn't bounce much, I'll be very suspicious. Anyway, what I then talked to Carl about is we went indoors because it was getting a bit windy, and the first thing I asked him, how much pressure does a groundsman feel?
It's definitely happening more and more in recent years that a lot of comments from players, coaches, media and all that, you know, they seem to carry a lot of weight even though there's not much behind it. It's very easy for someone, a player, to walk by and just have a pop at me or a throwaway comment and things like that. And then, it does affect the guys. You know, groundsmen put a lot into being here, long hours, weekends. I'm always thinking about the job. I think all head groundsmen are. You're always at night time, you've got something on your head, thinking about the next game or a month's time or a particular match. So any sort of little job we get does affect us personally, but it comes with the job, you know, and I don't think we'd do it if it really did affect us.
Actually, traditionally, groundsmen are quite grumpy. Yeah. But you're not, actually.
No. I was a grumpy groundsman when I was younger. Really, really grumpy. Clontarf, we had a rule, club rule, no football on the ground was always the way. And if I saw anyone with a football, I'd just kick it over the fence into the gardens and or burst it or something like that. But then I had a few arguments and things like that. And I got to a point where I said, you know, life's too short, it's... You know, it plays on my mind, it affects you, it rolls into the next day and things like that. So I've certainly chilled out a lot more, but that doesn't mean I'm a walkover, to be honest.
What about repairing pitches? And there's a lot of stuff recently about, like, obviously in the Champions Trophy last year, in the Cardiff game, England playing on a repaired pitch, a pitch which didn't kind of quite live up to what they were hoping. How quickly can you repair a pitch to make it playable for, say, an international?
In an ideal world, I'd like sort of 6 to 7 weeks between games. You play on it, finish it, water it, reseed it, clean it out. Ideally longer. Obviously, during something like the World Cup, for example, you haven't got that time. With there being so much cricket here at Lord's and other international venues, sometimes it's tricky to have a fresh pitch for every game. At times, you're sort of trying to manage what you've really been dealt with. You're dictated to slightly by, say, what fixtures you have. If you've got a couple of weeks between games, you can turn a pitch back around. It's not ideal, to be honest. What you probably want is games to be 1 or 2 days apart if you've got to use those pitches again. So you just hold on to it and play on it again.
How does it compare? I mean, obviously, the infrastructure and everything is very different, but what about the actual playing surface, the arena, how does that differ to the Aegeus Bowl?
I think in terms of the square-wise and how it's built and things like that, there's not much difference. The outfield, obviously, is a higher spec than what we had at the Aegeus Bowl. You can just tell that even by just walking across it, how dry and firm it is. So, obviously, you've got the slope as well, which I suppose if I have one concern, it's how to deal with the slope. The guys are obviously, I'm picking their brains a lot, the grounds team here, and they do say the water does run down the slope quite quickly when you're watering, so that'll be a challenge in itself. I didn't stand in the ground until I came here in December, my first day in the job, really. And when I stood in the middle looking at the pavilion, do feel yourself sort of falling over a little bit, so it's significant. And I think, yeah, certainly in terms of how to deal with it, with watering and how to manage pitches and things like that because of the slope is going to be interesting. It seems obviously weather patterns are changing quite quickly at the moment. When it rains, it really, really pours. And I think it looks like no matter what you do, it's going to run then as well. So it's a case even the guys have been out with the blotter going up and down, just to stop it from getting under the sheets, even off the outfield and how well it drains. So,
have you noticed that weather patterns changing?
Definitely. Really, really quickly as well. Definitely, there's more rain. It's heavier. When it comes, it really, really does come down. You don't get your light little trickles of rain anymore, which is quite nice overnight. And that's happened 10 years, I think, you know. Even in my career over in England, you can see it's happened quite quickly.
So that's the new Lords groundsman, Carl McDermott. There used to be a time when I started covering cricket, you just were not allowed on the Lords outfield. It was like an amazing experience. You ever got to walk on the outfield, and if you got to play there, what an incredible experience that must be. That was what I used to think when I used to start covering cricket in the late 80s. Of course, now everyone's on the ground before the start of play. There's almost more people on the ground than there are in the stands at, say, 10:30 in the morning.
That's actually what he said. It was one of his sort of slight irritations, was that people like you and me out there for the toss, yeah, getting in the way and treading on his precious grass, sort of like 50 or 60 people. Yeah. And why are they all there? I said to him, but we need to look at the pitch. Mm. We do all need to look at the pitch. I mean, we don't all need to look at the pitch at the toss, I suppose, but that's the time when it counts. If you look at the pitch 2 hours before, it's not going to look the same. So you want to see it when play is about to start, really, to get a sense of it. And so anyway, I sort of understand his complaint there, but there's not much I can do about it.
Yeah, one thing, just to pick on one of the things he said there, in terms of, like I said, the World Cup and what happened in the Champions Trophy last time in England and Wales in 2017, you know, how quickly can you turn a pitch around? There was that, you know, not controversy, but that was that comment over England playing on that used pitch for a semi-final in Cardiff. And he said, what did he say? 6 to 7 weeks between games is his preference for, you know, reusing the same surface. But he admits it's tricky to have a fresh pitch for every game. 2 weeks you can turn a pitch around, but he's saying it's not ideal. But if you know you've got back-to-back games, you know, say 2 games in 3 or 4 days, you can make, you essentially, I suppose what he was trying to say is you can make a 4-day pitch and play, you know, the first 1-day match on the first day and effectively the second one on what's effectively the fourth day of the pitch. You can sort of hold, what did he say, hold on to it was the way, you know, so I suppose you, what it means, you prepare it for a longer time. But ideally, you want to play on fresh pitches the whole time, especially in the World Cup. And I'm sure England would want to play on fresh pitches all the time. Mm. When I say fresh pitches, I mean new pitches. I don't think they necessarily want to play on sporty pitches. They want to play on pitches that are good for their big biffers.
Yeah, and that means having a bit of bounce. What I really liked about Carl was he didn't seem grumpy at all. And so many groundsmen, including Mick Hunt on occasion, they just lose it. I mean, I don't want to name any more names, but most of the groundsmen around the circuit have got their grumpy side. It's a hard job, isn't it?
And they talked about the pressure of it. Well, you're under scrutiny, aren't you? Your surface is definitely under scrutiny from players
and coaches. And it's not an exact science, is it?
Yeah.
So it is a tough job. I just remember, actually, the first groundsman I ever knew was at the Ealing Cricket Club grounds where I played club cricket, and he basically didn't want anyone on the field ever.
No.
And it was like that sign, keep off the grass, was up permanently, you know, from January to December.
Even on a Saturday afternoon when you're supposed to be playing.
Yeah. So I used to sort of try and hide that stupid sign because he put it up, even if there was a cloud in the sky. It was really irritating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it seems now as if grounds are a bit more relaxed, or perhaps they're just being forced to be a bit more relaxed about who can go on the field. I mean, for example, yeah. I mean, you've got quick cricket being played on the ground during, you know, lunch intervals now.
Actually, the Lords outfield, Carl said, look, you know, this outfield is seriously good.
Yeah.
And he showed me they're putting in some new drains at one end. And I looked at the sand base of the, it's about a foot deep, the sand underneath the grass, which is why it drains so well. So it's gravel, then sand on top, and then grass on top of that. But in the sand, there's plastic sort of fibres to hold it together as well. So it's sort of plastic and sand base with the grass on top. Really deep. I mean, like a foot deep of this sand, which is why, A, it drains so well. He said it's a bit dry at this time of year. But also, it does survive better with things like quick cricket, brass band, idiots like me walking out to do demonstrations on it. It's a better hard wearing surface, so yeah. I guess they don't have to worry so much.
Well, the transformation in the Lord's outfield is remarkable. I mean, in your day when you were playing, if it rained for half a day, that's it. You probably had a championship match didn't you?
My first game for Middlesex, it started on a Saturday. It rained in the morning. There was a lake on the outfield, and we didn't play till Monday.
Yeah.
So I never got to play my debut for 2 days until the Monday when it had dried out a bit more. And even then, it was a quagmire.
And there was a test match against Pakistan that England played after they put the new drainage in, where there was an amazing thunderstorm, and there was a lake on the ground. Actually, it's down the road from my home, where we're speaking now, there were huge floods. At Lord's, they played an hour later, didn't they? Three quarters of an hour later. And in your day, they wouldn't have played for a couple of weeks, probably.
And we were quite glad, actually, because we could put our feet up.
See, this is
could watch videos and
this is terrible for people who
play bridge.
Who've not played professional cricket. People who are great supporters of cricket, love cricket, love to go and watch. They cannot believe that actually cricketers just don't really like playing.
Well, I think the thing is they do, but not
very often.
Not 28 days out of 31, which is what it could be.
Yeah, no,
and that you, when it was August and it was 28 days out of 31, you just dreamt of a day of rain where you could play last card and take Mike Gatting's money.
Yeah. How often did you manage to do that then?
Well, he never had any money. He was one of those people who actually never had any cash.
Yeah.
So you go, oh, yeah, I'll pay you tomorrow. So... never won any money off him.
Right, OK, big year ahead, Yoz. And England will be starting their test series against West Indies next week. And next week we'll look ahead to that. And we'll also talk about your greatest, not yours, but our listeners' greatest innings of all time.
Look forward to it.
Speak to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.